It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's a new public sculpture standing at Lake Emily Park near Stevens Point. We talked to the work's creator about the significance of the location and what it symbolizes about Oneida culture. Now, the U.S. Department of Labor released the latest data on labor union membership last week. It saw a decline in the unionization rate nationwide and here in Wisconsin. The percentage of workers who reported being members of a labor union nationwide was down to 10.1%, the lowest rate since they've tracked that data. The rate went down despite high-profile cases of workers organizing at high-profile companies like Amazon and Starbucks around the country. The same data show that the total number of workers who belong to a union went up in 2022, but not at the same rate as non-union jobs, so that percentage of workers went down overall. Our next guest is here to help us make sense of the trends and look ahead to where organized labor could go from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does your workplace have a labor union? Are you a member? What are you getting from the union, do you think? What do you hope it could do better? If you don't work in a unionized place, do you wish you could? Call in with your experiences, your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Haywood is a distinguished professor of economics and director of the graduate program in human resources and labor relations at UW-Milwaukee. John, thanks for joining us today.
Rob, it's my great pleasure.
We've seen this longer-term decline in union membership in the U.S. and here in Wisconsin. Looking at these latest numbers, first of all, from the federal government, what, if anything, does it tell us about unions and labor in the U.S.?
Well, I think it tells us that even though labor has been having a moment over the last year or two, that moment has not been yet enough to reverse what has been a long-term secular trend. You mentioned that this was as low as the comparable data had ever shown it, but economists have gone back and tried to put together a longer time series, and it's probably the lowest since the National Labor Relations Act. Unionization probably hit a high point in the 1950s and has basically declined ever since.
Let's talk about that moment a little bit. The idea that, okay, we've got a tight labor market. We're seeing some successful organizing campaigns winning union votes anyway at the Starbucks and Amazons of the world. Why has that just been because it's companies we've heard of? Why hasn't that translated into higher union membership?
Well, that's a good question. I think there are a number of different parts to it. I think you're right that the tight labor market is part of the attempt to grow unions. You're more likely to be successful creating a union, or for that matter, going on strike if it's hard to replace you, and the low unemployment, and even more profoundly, the low labor force participation. That's the share of potential workers who are actually working. Both of those are indicative of a very tight labor market. So the short answer, I suppose, to the question is, it's one thing to organize and another thing to get to a first contract and actually be a unionized member under a union contract. So you mentioned Starbucks. I think we're at 250 successful organizing campaigns across the country, but there hasn't been one contract signed yet, Rob. So this process takes a long time. The firms have every incentive to draw it out, to hope things change, to hope the people who are interested in a union leave. So it's always a fraught and, frankly, long-term process to actually go from a non-union environment to a unionized one.
Labor laws and labor enforcement has changed over the years. Is part of the story here a tough climate for union organizing efforts under federal and state laws?
Well, yes. I think you should be careful to distinguish between those two sets of laws, federal and state. To mention state first, I mean, Wisconsin is well below the national average in unionization now. And that's because, and we didn't used to be, it wasn't very long ago that we were well above. But the reason is because of changes in state law, specifically Act 10, that made it much harder for public employees to unionize, and the right to work laws that made it much harder for private sector workers to organize. So the combination of those two changes in state law have made Wisconsin, frankly, have a lower unemployment rate than our neighbors. Maybe we're kind of tied with Iowa, but well below all of our other neighbors.
Talking to John Haywood. I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
I was just going to say that on the federal level, the interpretation of the laws has changed more than the laws themselves. So the ability, for example, to have permanent strikebreakers, as was threatened in the recent CNH strike here in Wisconsin, is a fine example. When the law's interpretation changes and allows employers to do that, then strikes become less successful and the advantages to organizing become less as well.
I wanted to ask, we're just hearing in the news that strike ended just over the weekend. This affected a lot of workers in Racine, some in Iowa as well. The United Auto Workers members had spent 7 months on strike. Could you describe why these strikes were happening despite the membership declines we're talking about here?
Sure. I think it's the same phenomena with respect to the organizing. I mean, the times over the last couple of years have been advantageous to try to organize and, frankly, to try to strike. You want to strike when you have a small chance of being replaced, when the firm really, really needs you. That's when you're going to have the most success. Now, we emphasize that the labor market is tight, and so that increases the chance of strikes. In fact, between 2021 and 2022, there was a 50% increase in the number of strikes. So 2022 was a big strike year, at least relative to recent times. And I think, you know, there, in addition to the labor market, in many of the cases, not particularly in the Racine and Burlington, Iowa case, but in many of the cases, the strikes have resulted also because of a realization that came from COVID to the workers that they were much more essential, and frankly, that their jobs were much harder than they thought. So, for example, the nurse strikes that have been going on this last year, most recently, very large strikes in both Minnesota and more recently New York City, nurses were finding that their jobs were more dangerous than they thought. And they struck in both of those cases, in part, over staffing ratios. So combination of COVID and the labor market, I think, are responsible for why we've seen more strikes.
Talking to John Haywood, professor of economics at UW-Milwaukee, looking at the state of organized labor in the United States. Union membership rates down a bit in the latest data, though the overall numbers of people in unions went up just a bit. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Pat is with us in northern Wisconsin. Pat, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon, John. I'd like to talk a little bit about membership decline, and I have a couple views on that. We've had a Republican governor in the state that did everything that he could to minimize labor, organized labor, through Act 10, through Right to Work. We've just diminished the importance of the union. We have members that can actually be in a union without paying any dues, membership to that union. Our Right to Work status has put us down there with states in the South. We get many members or many employees coming in from the South, from Right to Work states that can't make a living down there, that come to states that have organized labor to work on union job sites to get the benefits and the pay that is associated with that. I agree that we are losing the labor force, but the cards are stacked pretty well against us when we had a governor that did everything he could to break the unions in the state of Wisconsin.
And Pat, to clarify, were you a union member?
I'm a 39-year union member.
All right. Thanks, Pat, a lot for sharing your perspective. John, you had talked a little bit about the impact of Act 10 and Right to Work. And looking at charts pre and post, it is really quite striking. As you mentioned, Wisconsin well above the national average before 2010 when it comes to union membership rates, now well below. And there's that crossing point is right there in like 2011, 2012.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, I don't really disagree with much that Pat said. He's pointed to the reasons. At some fundamental level, unions are the creation of a government deciding that workers need a collective voice. So it's when they change that view, then unions are going to suffer. It took the National Labor Relations Act to create widespread unionism on the national level. States themselves make these laws. Pat emphasized the right to work law. And one of the consequences of the right to work law is that you can enjoy the benefits of a union contract without having to pay for the costs of your union negotiating that contract. So that means that the individuals will choose rationally, if they're thinking about dollars and cents only, they'll choose to work at a unionized employer but not join the union. And then pretty soon the union fails. So this is the result of the changes in law that you and I, Rob, have been talking about. Absolutely.
Pat, thanks for that call. We're talking to UW-Milwaukee economics professor John Haywood, looking at the latest trends in labor union participation, the latest data out from 2022. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about a labor union membership, organizing trends around the country, strikes around the country? Were you surprised by some of the organized labor activity we saw across the country last year? Are you involved in something in your own workplace? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with John Haywood, Distinguished Professor of Economics at UW-Milwaukee, with us today to look at changes in labor union participation in Wisconsin and around the country. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your own experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I guess my comment is sometimes it's not always about the money. Sometimes it's about working conditions and time off and sick leave and stuff. A good example would be that potential railroad strike where it sounded like they offered a lot of money, but that wasn't really the issue. And if you can negotiate over stuff like that, even if it doesn't involve wages and benefits, sometimes, that helps out not only attracting workers, but also makes a better work life for the employees.
Jimmy, thanks for that call. I think when we talk about labor unions, sometimes, John, we ask, does this raise wages and benefits? But as Jimmy was saying, working conditions are part of the story, too. Can you talk about that?
I'd be delighted to. I think Jimmy's exactly right. I mean, he mentioned the railroad strike. The issue there was certainly days off. I mentioned earlier the nurses' strike, where the issue was the staffing ratios. They thought they were being in workplaces that were potentially dangerous for their own patients because there were too few nurses for the patients. So these are definitely working condition issues. And frankly, unions rose and have been successful in part because of their ability to give voice to these kinds of concerns and to have them fixed. I also like Jimmy's point that sometimes if you can fix these working conditions, the consequence is good for everyone. It's not just good for the workers, it's not just good for the patients or the clients or the customers, but it could even potentially be good for the firm. They can learn more about what makes a happy workforce. They can learn more from people on a shop floor about how to improve production. Having a union provides a formalized way of communication that while managers have traditionally felt usurps their control, can actually lead to more cooperative and superior outcomes. So hats off to Jimmy for making that point.
Jimmy, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Drew is with us next in Fitchburg. Drew, hi.
Hi. I was always curious why unions aren't protected under the constitutional right to peaceably assemble.
Oh, interesting, Drew. Thanks. Should we allow unions on a more fundamental level, Drew is saying.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And I'm no constitutional lawyer. I'm an economist. But I think, you know, there's a difference probably between assembly and group activity. So, you know, assembly, getting together, talking, free expression, saying the employer is lousy, that may very well be protected constitutionally, but the ability to withhold as a group your labor, maybe not.
Drew, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to John Haywood, Distinguished Professor of Economics at UW-Milwaukee, looking at labor unions around the country and here in Wisconsin. What's driving some of the latest trends? Still a general downward trend in the rate of unionization, even though the numbers went up a little in the most recent data. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. We heard from Mary in Eau Claire, who couldn't stay on the air, but was wondering about the success of recent efforts to unionize Amazon. And we've seen some work sites, John, a vote for unionization. I think it might be in the same category as Starbucks, where that doesn't necessarily mean they have a negotiated contract yet.
That's exactly right. So far at Amazon, what we've seen is a warehouse in the greater New York area successfully go through a campaign, but there's no contract yet. So we'll see. They're not yet sort of union members under a union contract.
Now, can you talk about that process? You mentioned it's lengthy. What has to happen between that union vote and a union contract being negotiated? Can that drag on forever, hypothetically?
I suppose. I mean, each side is supposed to bargain in good faith. That is in the eye of the beholder often and can end up in court. Failure to bargain is unfair labor practice. The Starbucks example, we're coming up almost on a year since the first one, was that in Buffalo, perhaps, successfully held an election. So the incentive, first of all, let me say it's complicated to write any contract. You've got two parties sitting down for the first time to try to itemize exactly what the jobs are, exactly who gets paid what for when, exactly what the terms of employment are. And this is new for both sides if they've never been unionized before. So that's going to necessarily take some time. But in addition, one of the things we've learned is that there's a big incentive for employers to drag the process out. By doing that, the economic climate might change. Workers might feel suddenly they need their job and that low unemployment rate is now a high unemployment rate and they're worried. The people who were fundamental in organizing the union may have left and gone elsewhere. Indeed, there's an entire industry out there of the labor consultants that advise major firms about exactly what delaying tactics to use.
When people think of unions, John, they might think of a big factory, or maybe if they're thinking public sector, the teachers' union. How much attention has there been to the service sector, one of the big employers in this country?
Well, that's absolutely right. And if you had to give one out of three reasons for why there's a big decline, the incredible shift from a manufacturing economy to a service economy would probably be in that top three. And the service industry is notoriously hard to organize because you've got workers that are not necessarily full-time. You've got workers who aren't necessarily there a long tenure. You've got only small plants, typically. You know, I mean, a Starbucks has nothing like the employees at a auto assembly plant. And so you work hard to organize, and to some extent, there are great economies of scale. And so small service shops have been sort of last and latest in getting organized. There's no question. But it's starting to happen, as we've been describing. Here in Milwaukee, our Collectivo coffee shop, by one vote, successfully voted for unionization. And, you know, there are examples. So it's a growth area. I mean, that's one way to look at it.
In our last minute or so, John, 2023, what do you have your eye on most closely when it comes to unions in America?
Good question. Well, as specifically, I'm really interested in the contracts with UPS, always a big trendsetter, important contract. I'm interested to see whether there are more strikes that go on, keep that trend going. And I'm really interested to see whether we finally get some contracts out of all these service sector votes.
We'll leave it there, John. Thanks again for joining us today.
My great pleasure, Rob. You take care.
You too. That's John Haywood, Distinguished Professor of Economics and Director of the Graduate Program in Human Resources and Labor Relations at UW-Milwaukee. He's with us today looking at how labor union membership changed in 2022, year to year, and over time. There is still time for you to share your story if you've been in a unionized workplace or wish you had or were in one and wish you weren't. Love to hear from you about your experience there. And is there a subject related to the workplace, organized labor or not, that you would like to hear us talk about here on the Ideas Network? Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Or send us a message over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Love to hear your stories and your suggestions for future workplace conversations along the way. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, we'll take a look at the latest efforts to connect technical college programs here in Wisconsin with some of the biggest job needs here in the state. There are concerns from some employers that there's a disconnect between available programs and available jobs. You can, again, let us know if you have a story to share. If you went through a technical college program, did it get you ready for a job? If you're looking to hire people, do you work with technical colleges to make sure you have people who are trained and ready to rock at your workplace? That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8. Check it out here on the Ideas Network. On last week's edition of Food Friday, we got some great advice on making casseroles. You called in and shared your favorites and some that you remember from growing up. We got some more great suggestions from Jacqueline on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jacqueline writes, I just made a go-to casserole of chicken, rice, pinto beans, salsa, and taco spices garnished with sharp cheddar cheese. Sounds good. Straight ahead. Love it. She goes on, another is broccoli cheddar soup, rice and sauteed chicken chunks, tuna noodle casserole, cheeseburger macaroni with tomato cubes. Now, that was a list of different casseroles, but I read it wrong the first time. I thought that was one super casserole with chicken, rice, tuna noodles, cheeseburger macaroni, tomatoes, and broccoli cheddar soup. All in one recipe, but no. But wait, who says we couldn't make that super casserole? If you rise to the challenge, let us know. I may not volunteer as a taste tester. Pushing the boundaries of cooking, this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Wisconsin's 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline launched about 6 months ago. The state's crisis services coordinator tells us how it's been going so far. Now, how often do you think about the longevity of things you create? A lot of the stuff we might make with our hands probably have some sort of shelf life. But our next guest creates with copper, and his works of art are meant to stand the test of time. Mark Fisher is a contemporary sculptor and member of the Oneida Nation of Green Bay Turtle Clan. He's recently completed a couple of public installations, including a depiction of indigenous culture near Stevens Point at Lake Emily Park. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
What got you into working with copper as a medium for sculpture, Mark?
It was just antibacterial, antiviral. It's safe for all occasions, and it just seemed like the right element to work with.
One of the things I love about copper, at least sometimes, is how it ages and changes in color over the years, but still looks pretty cool. Is that something you see happening as your outdoor works go through the decades?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It turns so absolutely beautiful when the patina really takes over the sculpture. And the ones that I installed by Lake Emily were patinaed by me prior, but the patina continues to age and get more and more brilliant to a turquoise color. And so that's another reason to work with it, is its beauty.
Can you tell us about the installation at Lake Emily Park? This is near Stevens Point. Can you paint us a picture, first of all?
Oh, it's a beautiful, beautiful area. As I went through it, there's dancing grounds that have been there for over 500 years. You can see just everywhere on how natives had lived there, with a very large burial ground with lots and lots of mounds. It was very a spiritual experience for me to be there. And so when the people from Lake Emily wanted to honor the natives that lived there for well over 500 years, I would say probably well over 1,000 years, that there was Ray Ricer, Dr. Ray Ricer, was the lead person there, and he was an archaeologist that oversaw all things that happened there. And Karen Ann Hoffman, she's on the Wisconsin Arts Board and also an Oneida Indian. And they, you know, told me of this special spot. And when I went there, I just couldn't believe how beautiful the spot was.
And then your sculpture there is called the Sustainers. Can you tell us a little bit about what it looks like and what it represents?
Well, the Sustainers for the Oneidas are the three sisters. And the three sisters' names are Corn, Beans, and Squash. And the Corn is the big, strong girl. And the Beans crawl up around her, and the Beans, or the Squash, keeps the ground moist and weed-free. And those three are always together. And so it was something I felt was important to, you know, for everybody to know that that's how we typically grow food, with those three together. And I also brought fish into the picture, too, on that piece. And the fish was designed to be to show that we also, you know, used fish. And, you know, being Lake Emily, I felt incorporating that was real important.
And before this piece, you worked on an installation in downtown Green Bay called Among the Aspens. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Oh, Among the Aspens was a beautiful thing. When Green Bay had come to me and asked about what I thought community was without talking about humans, and I instantly responded, well, it has to be aspens. And they're going, well, why aspens? And I says, because their inner roots are all connected. They talk to each other. They grow in groups. And the oldest tree in America is an 80,000-year-old aspen tree in Fish Creek, Utah. Aspens never hibernate. They continue to grow all winter long. They lose their leaves, but they continue to grow, in which the animals of the forest can take advantage of having, you know, fresh sap and fresh bark to be able to eat. And so the aspens is true, you know, it's a community tree. It's what represents humans in plant form.
What do you hope people take away from seeing and interacting with these public sculptures you have out in these prominent places?
Well, the ones in Green Bay, I wanted to show the past, the present, and the future of Green Bay. And the Oneida Indians have been living in Green Bay area for well over 200 years and felt that we are a strong part of the community. So there's I drew in petroglyphs and pictographs that we know of or what they mean, because some of them we don't know what they mean. And so these petroglyphs or pictographs that are on each piece are all highlighted real bright. But they talk about you know, where Green Bay's going, and Green Bay's going in the right spot. And the same thing with Lake Emily. What really wonderful people that want to make a difference in their communities do this type of thing. You know, they put up a monument to remind us all on how we should be taking care of Wisconsin.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thanks for the interview. I appreciate it, and I'm glad to let people know a little bit more about Native Americans.
That's Mark Fisher, contemporary sculptor, member of the Oneida Nation of Green Bay. We talked to him today about a couple of his latest art installations, as you heard, in Green Bay and near Stevens Point. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with more on the mission behind an annual benefit concert.
There's a father in Madison who turned a tragedy into a cause for hope. Mike Gamal lost his son to epilepsy, then founded the organization and benefit concert, Joey's Song. As WPR's Gabby Vinnick tells us, it supports people with epilepsy.
Mike Gamal is not a rock star, but he knows how to get them to rally around a cause.
As you start out an email or a phone call with, "My five-year-old son died and I need your help," most people, they can't always help, but most people will say, "Well, what can I do to help?"
In 2010, his son Joey Gamal died, just 1 week shy of his fifth birthday. He suffered a severe and rare form of epilepsy called Dravet syndrome. Epilepsy is a chronic neurological disease that causes seizures. To Gamal, Joey was a carefree and happy kid.
He made the best of life and was always laughing and always smiling and always, he was in his own world, but he was never had a down moment. And those are the kinds of things that I think about.
Gamal was always a music fan, and so was Joey, especially when he heard a song by Sesame Street's Elmo.
He would grab everybody by their finger and make them get up and dance, and he kind of had this little boppy dance, and his word for dance was D, D.
As a way to work through his grief, Gamal created the nonprofit Joey's Song in honor of his son and their family's positive memories of him. The organization raises money to fund research grants and support programs for people with epilepsy. He started selling CDs, but found that the events Gamal paired them with raised far more money. Gamal said there are plenty of causes to support, and he's learned to not take no from an artist personally. Yet his tenacity has helped Gamal successfully assemble an impressive lineup that would catch the eye of any 90s rock fan. Performers include members of Garbage, Soul Asylum, Belly, and Fountains of Wayne. There's also the Wisconsin Musicians Supergroup, the Know-It-All Boyfriends. All of the musicians play for free. Letters to Cleo singer Kay Hanley was one of the performers at Joey's Song this year. She says her daughter experienced seizures, but it took a long time to receive a proper diagnosis.
We had a neurologist that treated a certain kind of epilepsy, and then she developed into another kind of epilepsy, and the doctor didn't know how to treat it, and we didn't know where to go.
Finally, they found a pediatric epilepsy specialist at LA Children's Hospital.
She said, "In my estimation, your treatment has been a failure." And we all burst into tears, but like, it wasn't sad tears, it was happy tears, because it was like, we finally felt like we were understood.
Hanley says her daughter, who's 23 now, has been treated and is doing well, but she says it's important to continue raising awareness. According to the Epilepsy Foundation, 1 in 26 people will get epilepsy in their lifetime. Data from the CDC shows that in Wisconsin, nearly 60,000 people have the disorder. Gamal says he wanted to start a charity dedicated to fighting epilepsy when Joey was alive. But after Joey passed, Gamal tapped into his Madison music scene connections to kickstart the organization.
The prognosis then and even today isn't really great with Dravet's. So we knew that there wasn't a lot we were going to do to make Joe's life better, even if he had survived.
But he knew he could do something to help other families.
For me, it was like, okay, let's try to change something. If we can make one family not go through what we went through our efforts, then it's worth whatever hours that we put into it.
Years later, Gamal says he considers many of the musicians involved in Joey's Song his friends.
WPR's Gabby Vinnick brought us that story on Joey's Song, an organization that supports people with epilepsy. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, how has the new 988 Lifeline been helping people here in Wisconsin? We'll find out how it works and what services it provides. That's coming up next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Join WPR tomorrow night at 7 for live coverage of the 2023 State of the State address by Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers. After the governor, hear the Republican response from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. WPR's Sean Johnson and PBS Wisconsin's Frederica Freiberg are your hosts for this special coverage. It's the 2023 State of the State Address, tomorrow night at 7 here on Wisconsin Public Radio and online at WPR.org. Now, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline officially became the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline in mid-July of last year. That meant rather than having to call an 800 number, people seeking help could just call or text 988. According to data from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, that number received 6,000 calls in July alone after it launched in the middle of the month. We're past the six-month mark of the new number being in operation. We wanted to check back on how things have been going for Wisconsin's 988 call center, managed by Family Services of Northeast Wisconsin. Caroline Crehan-Newman is Crisis Services Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Caroline, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This was a long time in the making, as I understand it. How big a transition was it to go from that the older 800 number to this new three-digit 988 number?
Well, it's a very big deal. I think it's something that was a long time coming. I think, as many of us know, we have a three-digit number, 911. We have several other three-digit numbers, 411, 211, for different needs that we have. And mental health and substance use crisis is certainly something that needs the attention. And 988 is here to support Wisconsinites and people across the nation.
When someone in need calls 988, what can they expect? What do they get?
So when someone calls 988, we like to be really transparent. We have all of this information on our webpage, but when you call, you'll receive a very brief automated response to let you know that you've reached the Lifeline, and there are prompts asking if you are a veteran or if you'd like to speak to a Spanish speaker. And then once you have answered those prompts and have a brief hold, maybe 20 to 30 seconds, you'll be connected with a counselor. If you're calling from Wisconsin, you'll be connected with, like you mentioned earlier, Family Services of Northeast Wisconsin, who are our partners with Wisconsin DHS. And when people call and they're connected with a counselor, usually that counselor just opens up the floor to the person who's calling and asking, what caused you to call 988 today? And you sort of go through that journey of being provided support by a trained counselor.
Are they able then to refer to further services if needed?
Yeah, so our center here in Wisconsin has a really extensive contract with 211 Wisconsin, which provides referral resources all across the state. And so although our 988 Wisconsin Center is located in Green Bay, if you are anywhere throughout the state, if you live in Iowa or Grant County or Bayfield or Kenosha, and you call 988, the counselor on the phone will be able to, look into their computer and be able to very quickly provide resources and referrals to you, whether that be mental health related or substance use related, domestic abuse, housing, things like that.
And I understand texting is an option instead of a call or in addition to a call.
Yes, both texting and chat are an option for 988. Chat has been around for a while. It existed before the transition to 988. Texting is newer. What we're seeing in terms of data, chat has maintained similar numbers as it did years prior, but we are seeing an increase in texts. I think the more advertising and the more people learn about 988, texting is a really appealing option, especially for those that are maybe younger and just more comfortable with the anonymity of text and the accessibility.
We're talking to Caroline Crean Newman with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, the Crisis Services Coordinator there. Talk about the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Replaced the older, longer number. It's a three-digit number now. It replaced that system in mid-July of last year. Caroline, funding for this program, the federal government put a lot into it at the outset. Is there a sustainable source of funding to keep these efforts going into the future here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so that's something not only Wisconsin, but basically every other state across the nation is looking at, sustainable funding. There are different avenues to sustainable funding. The federal legislation that created 988, that was passed and signed into law in 2020, did allow states to, or gave states the permission to pass some type of fee or a tax, whether that be a telecom fee or tax, or something else, which is how 911 is funded across most states. So it's something that we're exploring. We are currently working through funds from a federal grant. We've received a couple of grants, and the federal government just awarded us additional money through supplemental funding. So we're looking at long-term. We, of course, need and want to make this service sustainable. Yeah, we're working towards that.
And Caroline, I understand part of the incentive for doing this three-digit number system was it would be more accessible, easier for people to reach when they need it. Has that borne out so far in these first 6 months, do you think?
Yeah, we have seen an increase in definitely in calls and definitely in texts. Wisconsin, along with I know some other Midwestern states, are going to be launching their own statewide campaigns. So everyone listening can expect to see maybe commercials, billboards, radio ads for 988 in Wisconsin. Our state-specific tagline is 24/7 call, chat, text. And so we're really hoping to reach more people, to let people know what to expect when they reach out, and that support is there if they need it.
I know different states are offering different services in some cases for different community members. You mentioned, for example, there's a Spanish language option, an option for veterans. Some states have provided special counseling for LGBTQ people who call in. Do you have other tailored programs like that, or are you looking for to provide more in the future?
So the crisis continuum of services can be a little confusing. Mm-hmm. In terms of veterans and Spanish speaking, that's all a part of the national rollout. In terms of Wisconsin, we have a plethora of services that are largely delivered through the county system. And so if someone calls 988 and needs further services, maybe it's appropriate for a mobile team to be dispatched out to where they are in the community. Maybe they're looking for a referral to a therapist. Maybe they're looking for more of a wraparound program. That person may be asked if they're interested in being transferred to a county crisis program. And so we do have a lot of services in place, but we're continuing to look and assess how to make 988 stronger, how to reach more people. And if that means including different or a variation of services in the future, that's something we're definitely open to.
Is 988 a service that might be used by maybe not the person in crisis themselves, but say a family member who is concerned?
Yes, absolutely. We see that quite a bit. So we see sometimes a friend who was talking to one of their peers at school who maybe expressed some suicidal ideation. I don't really want to be here anymore. This is just so hard. We see parents calling, children calling about their parents. We see really a wide array of different people who are calling, and that is perfectly, we encourage that. If you are concerned about someone, please feel free to call, and whether we can get that person on the phone or the counselor can provide support to that person on how to better support their friend, daughter, son, parent, that's all encouraged.
In just our last few moments, Caroline, I know there's labor difficulties in a lot of fields. Are you able to keep up and have enough staff on hand to meet the demand here?
Yeah, so that's something Wisconsin is actively working on, as are many other states. You certainly nailed it. There is a staffing shortage, and it's no surprise that this work is incredibly challenging. And so one of the things that we're working on and we're working on with Family Services is how to unroll or roll out a remote workforce. And so what does it look like to be able to hire staff and counselors throughout the state who are supporting 988, taking calls, chats, and texts remotely while also being supported by supervisors and leadership in the organization? So I think in some ways the pandemic has opened up a remote workforce and will make that possible and easier for us to make 988 a success.
Caroline, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Caroline Crean Newman with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services talking about the rollout of the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Tomorrow, a look at technology layoffs and opportunities in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we talk to a Wisconsin scientist who's a co-author of a new international report about removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.